From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Our stolen future. Scientific research reveals that toxic chemicals are threatening our very survival. But where are the voices of presidential candidates on this critical issue? A debate on the counterterrorism bill. While illegal wiretaps and secret trials were cut from the House bill, they could still become law if the Clinton administration has its way. We'll hear from one man whose daughter died in the Oklahoma City bombing.
I think the fact that I lost Julie in the bombing, that there's nothing will bring her back, that we need something to try to help prevent something like this from happening again. What we had expected was a bill that addressed terrorism. And, of course, what we ended up with was not a bill at all that addressed terrorism. We didn't end up with anything except, I think, infringement on a lot of people's civil liberties.
And we'll talk about the bill's limits on death row appeals. What qualities would you like to see in the next president of the United States? We'll tell you how you can share your ideas with other listeners and the candidates. All this coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. When was the last time you heard the major presidential candidates, Bob Dole, for example, talking about the toxic chemicals that threaten us, or President Clinton responding to the anti-NAFTA environmentalists, saying that since NAFTA over the last 2 years, that environmental standards have gone down in this country and have been worsened in places like Mexico? Well, today we're going to get a lesson on what's happening in the environment from what some are calling the Rachel Carson of the modern age. We're joined now by Theo Colburn. Theo Colburn is the senior scientist with the World Wildlife Fund and a recognized expert on endocrine disrupting chemicals. And she is co-author of a new book that is just out this week called Our Stolen Future: Are We Threatening Our Fertility, Intelligence, and Survival? A Scientific Detective Story. The book is so important that yesterday, before the release, yesterday there was a press conference that she attended along with her co-authors, but the day before, the pesticide industry had their scientists come out in force to try to deal with some of the questions that were going to be raised when the book came out. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Theo Colburn.
Thank you for inviting me to be here.
Well, why don't you tell us about what is threatening our fertility, intelligence, and survival?
Well, Amy, since about 1920, we have released a large number of chemicals into the environment that were never in the environment before. You're sitting there today with over 500 measurable chemicals in your body that no one had in their body before the 1920s. And we thought these chemicals were safe. We either thought they were inert, they wouldn't affect us, or we thought they wouldn't cause cancer or gross and obvious birth defects. But what we understand now is that these chemicals pass from the mother to the developing baby in her womb, and they interfere with the chemical messengers that tell an embryo how to develop, how to grow, tell a cell where to move, tell a nerve cell how to develop. And we know now that we have chemicals in our bodies that can affect our children so that their endocrine systems, their immune systems, their nervous systems, and their behavior and intelligence could very well be affected as a result of this exposure in the womb. You know, when you don't build a house correctly, the foundation isn't correct, the house is never sound. You don't see pathologically sick children running around, but we may have children running around whose potentials are compromised.
And where are these chemicals coming from?
Well, the original batch, of course, came out of the production of pesticides, organochlorine pesticides, that were made to persist for a long time, and unfortunately, they're still persisting. We've restricted the production and use of some of these in this country, but we haven't around the world. There are large volumes of these chemicals being produced and released today in other parts of the world. And also, we have industrial chemicals, like the PCBs, that made your industry possible. Without the PCBs, we wouldn't have electricity served to us today that we would have. Their fire retardants, they have been very important in how we have actually improved our lifestyle and actually our whole economy is based upon chemicals that do this. Plastics. Only recently, it's really very interesting, was only since we brought attention to this possible effect that in a laboratory, not in Tufts University on the eastern part of the United States and Stanford University on the west coast of the United States, two separate labs working under different conditions found that two components of plastic actually leach out of the containers into whatever they're holding and can affect. In this instance, these people were working with breast cancer cells, of all things, and they were looking for reasons why breast cancer cells replicate. And their breast cancer cells began replicating, and they couldn't figure out why. Well, they found out it was components leading out of the plastics that were holding these breast cancer cells.
You know, it's interesting when you hear about, for example, the relation to breast cancer and chemical pollutants, because there have been some studies coming out now that link the two, although there's a lot of emphasis we see in scientific studies on genetic
yes.
makeup.
Mm-hmm.
But just politically, it's very difficult to get this information out because you have large PR firms like Porto Novelli that represent the industry and also represent the American Cancer Society pro bono. And so mm-hmm. they get the American Cancer Society to put out statements that there are no definitive studies at this point linking breast cancer to toxic pollutants.
Well, see, that's an interesting point because we know now that certain cells during their developmental stages or certain organs and tissues, like your secondary sex organs, the prostate, the testes, the breasts, okay. If during embryonic development an individual in a laboratory, this has been demonstrated, if an individual is exposed to these chemicals that we're talking about, they lay down more receptors in these cells as they start developing so that they're more sensitive later on throughout life. It's like a time bomb being planted in this developing embryo at that time so that they not only respond, then these cells not only respond to the internally or the naturally produced estrogens in the body, or the external ones, which we are adding to our body burden from our food, our air, our water, from our exposure to these kinds of chemicals. Now, if this is the case, you would not expect to find in a woman's breast today or in her fat the chemical that actually induced her susceptibility to cancer. And that's our big concern. How do you trace these things back? The same thing applies to sperm count. There's a reduction in sperm count today. In all probability, in many instances, that problem is a result of a male being exposed to elevated levels of estrogens during embryonic development or an anti-androgen, something that's blocking the message that the testosterone is telling to that male's testicles. You produce more Sertoli cells. Because when you reach adulthood, it's the number of Sertoli cells that actually has a lot of control over the number of sperm you can produce.
We're talking with Dr. Theo Colburn, and she's co-author, along with Diane Dumanoski and Peter Myers, of the new book, Our Stolen Future, Are We Threatening Our Fertility, Intelligence, and Survival? A Scientific Detective Story. Now, the day before your big press conference yesterday, where you released this book, there was another press conference that was held by a group of scientists. And they're a group of scientists who call themselves the Advancement of Sound Science Coalition. Do you know about this group?
Oh, yes, we know about this group.
Can you tell us who they are? Because these groups, like the Advancement of Sound Science Coalition, are playing a key role right now in Congress. In fact, many are saying they are writing the legislation, the anti-environmental legislation that is repealing regulations that have been laid down over the last decades.
Amy, I really don't know who these people are. That's how apolitical I am. I work away from the political arena. I do my science, and I try to do it very objectively, and I never report on science that I haven't discussed with the scientists who have done the work. So I don't know who these people are. I have seen the material that appeared in the paper, and in some of it, it's really very interesting. I think they're trying to cloud the issue. That's about all I can say now.
Well, why don't we play a little bit right now of a comment of one of the scientists yesterday who was speaking out, making reference to your book and the kind of information that was going to be coming out. His name was Jonathan Tolman. He's an environmental policy analyst at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and he was debunking the idea that man-made estrogen-like compounds affect the health of human beings.
A great deal of attention now is being focused on the fact that synthetic chemicals have exhibited estrogenic effects in laboratory studies. The chemicals most prominently cited are PCBs and DDT, both of which have been banned in the United States. Compared with phytoestrogens, the concern over synthetic chemicals may be somewhat overstated. It takes nearly 1 million of these synthetic chemical estrogen molecules to have the same effect as one synthetic estrogen molecule, such as DES, which is what is in most the pill, essentially. Since total intake of these pesticides is significantly lower than the naturally occurring phytoestrogens, the estrogen exposure from synthetic chemicals has been estimated at 0.000025 microgram estrogen equivalents per day. In other words, the estimated estrogenic effects from plant estrogens in our diets is 40 million times that of the synthetic chemicals.
So, of course, his main point, this scientist who was brought out by the Advancement of Sound Science Coalition, his main point is that naturally occurring toxins and estrogens are actually more harmful than the toxic chemicals you're talking about.
Well, let's start at the beginning here. We do know that there are plant estrogens that we have evolved with. Mankind has evolved with these plants, and we have been exposed to these plants over a lifetime. And those individuals who were affected by the plants were sort of weeded out of our society. We are the survivors that are left that have the defense mechanisms to deal with plant estrogens. Why is it that, and remember now, the chemicals I'm talking about have only been introduced into the environment, what is it now, 1990? About 70 years ago, we started becoming exposed to those. We have had no chance to evolve with those chemicals. And the interesting thing here is, also, it looks like the chemicals that we have introduced into the environment, these man-made chemicals, actually do an end run around the body's mechanism that the body has evolved with to protect us from these kind of chemicals, so that they slip into the embryo. They get into the developing embryo, and they do have an effect.
Why are they called hormone-disrupting chemicals?
Well, okay, just you sitting there right now, you wouldn't be alive if you didn't have hormones telling your cells what to do, how to function. These keep us alive. They control your metabolism, your intelligence, you know, your body heat. Hormones are very, very important, and there are a lot of these operating in your body, but at extremely low concentrations. I mean, you would have to be monstrous if, you know, if we had to have lots of hormone with us. Now, these hormones that we have introduced, these chemicals we've introduced into our system today and now are getting into our body, look like or interfere with the ones that are naturally there, that tell us how to function, tell an embryo how to develop. And that's called disruption. It's disrupting the message. So basically, we're getting garbled messages on how to develop and how to form. Now, think of thyroid hormone. Thyroid hormone is critical for the development of the brain. And there are a number of chemicals out there. It's been demonstrated in the laboratory. We actually know the mechanisms, how these synthetic chemicals interfere with the transport of thyroid hormone in the system, how they interfere with enzymes that convert the thyroid hormone to a more active form. We've got all these models in the laboratory. And we're seeing the same thing in the field in animals. And now what we're asking for is a research agenda to see if these are not some of the things that are contributing to such things as attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
How?
Because there are genetically deprived individuals, a very small percentage of the children with ADHD have a genetic deficiency. And their deficiency is called thyroid hormone resistance. They can't respond to the thyroid hormone. Then we have a whole bunch of other kids out there that have HD, but there's no explanation for it. And this is what we want to work on now. Could it be that these children were exposed to enough of these kind of chemicals during embryonic development so their brain just didn't get wired the way it should be? And so we use the model of the genetically disturbed child as an example of how now to study this. And we need research put into this. This is very, very important.
We're talking with Dr. Theo Coburn again, who is co-author of Our Stolen Future, Are We Threatening Our Fertility, Intelligence, and Survival? A scientific detective story. She's being hailed as the Rachel Carson of our age, 30 years after Rachel Carson wrote her incredible book, Silent Spring, to alert us to the dangers of DDT and DDE. The industry certainly came down hard on her, trying to discredit her work. She suffered with that for many years. And now this new book, Our Stolen Future. Now, in Tuesday's New York Times, in the science section, there was a very interesting piece, Old Nemesis DDT Finds Remote Albatrosses, and it's about a study that your organization, the World Wildlife Fund, actually funded.
No, we didn't fund it.
Were involved with?
We designed it. It's our study. We created it, and then we were able to get support from EPA to do the study.
Sorry, I guess I had funds on my mind.
Yes.
Because last year the study was halted because of budget cuts at the EPA, canceling a final season of field work. But finally, the research has been published, and I was interested, considering that this is an election show where we talk about politics every day, about how when you talk about sustainable development and when you talk about environmental issues, it really cuts across the political rhetoric, and it really cuts through it because political rhetoric is about short-term gain. You can introduce legislation, you can get it passed, and then you don't have to deal with the consequences of it. And here in this piece, it talks about, one of the scientists talks about how our research demonstrates that global controls on the distribution of persistent bioaccumulative toxic compounds need to be considered. The problem can't be approached on a country-by-country basis.
Exactly. One of our concerns today is that people are reaching a background level in a number of the industrialized nations of concentrations of these persistent organic pollutants, the ones that we released. And these chemicals are in everyone's bodies. DDT breaks down to DDE, and this is what you find in human tissue. You find PCBs. The interesting thing here is that we went to the North Pacific. We thought we'd pick the biggest, deepest, most pristine pot of water on Earth to see if these chemicals were really a global problem. Did we need to do something about it? All the predictions from land-based work and the Great Lakes works predicted yes, but we wanted to be sure. We found that these birds that feed only in the mid-ocean have concentrations of DDT in their eggs now when they go back to Midway Island to nest.
And this is what, like 1,000 miles away from Hawaii?
That's right, yes, north of Hawaii, and that we think is clean water, you know. These birds actually have concentrations of DDT in them, and we know it's fresh DDT. You can tell by the breakdown products as you do the chemistry. The chemists know this is fresh DDT coming into the system. The other thing that's very interesting is, too, here is that these birds have elevated concentrations of furans and dioxins in them compared to the birds in the Great Lakes. Now, furans and dioxins come from the combustion of products that have chlorine and organic material in them. This is mid-ocean. We didn't think that these things blew on the wind that far out into the ocean. We do know ocean currents mix. And remember, these birds feed only on the surface of the ocean.
Are we talking about incinerators?
We're talking about incinerators, burning. Mm-hmm. The plastics we find in the bellies of these chicks when the parents come back, they're picking food off the surface of the ocean, and they regurgitate plastics into the baby chicks. And these are partially burned plastics. That's how you produce dioxins. You know, it's very interesting. There is an international effort on this, and I am very excited about it. I'm really pleased.
We're talking to Dr. Theo Coburn. We're going to come back to her in just a minute. Again, co-author of Are We Threatening Our Fertility, Intelligence, and Survival? It's times like this that I wish we could open the phones right now and take your calls. Coming up after our musical break, we'll continue with Dr. Coburn and then move on to a discussion, a debate on counterterrorism. The counterterrorism bill that was just passed by the House, is it about terrorism or is it about something else? But first, this. Mm-hmm. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Democracy Now! Is Pacifica Radio's national daily grassroots election show. Actually, I'm headed down to Baton Rouge for the weekend, where I'm going to the Conference on Dioxin, and we'll be bringing you some of the speeches from the people, the activists from around the country. There are more than 450 of them who will be gathering to deal with that issue in this country, dealing with issues of environmental justice and environmental racism. There seems to be efforts now to encourage industry to actually locate. They're getting tax breaks, locate in poor urban centers. They talk about jobs. Often the environment issues are pitted against jobs. We're going to go on with this discussion of the environment, and then we're going to be talking about counterterrorism. Is the bill that's just been passed by the House, is it an effort to actually counter terrorism? But right now, again, our guest, Dr. Theo Colburn. She is a senior scientist with the World Wildlife Federation, the World Wildlife Fund here in Washington, D.C., and she's co-author of the new book, Our Stolen Future, Are We Threatening Our Fertility, Intelligence, and Survival? A Scientific Detective Story. What's happening internationally, Dr. Colburn, on the issue of controlling these endocrine disruptors?
It's very interesting. It started in the Baltic countries because they actually end up with a lot of these things blowing north, getting into their water. They're north of all the industrial activity in Europe. And they signed an agreement last summer to actually phase out in one generation by 2015 persistent organic pollutants and endocrine disruptors. That was picked up, and actually we had a big meeting here. Our State Department hosted it. Tim Wirth led it. And we actually got an agreement of more than 100 nations signing on to start phasing out persistent organic pollutants like the PCBs, the DDT that I just talked about a minute ago. And they're working on strategies now on how to proceed.
Which are the major industries that create these toxins?
Well, for one thing, you know, the pesticide industry, of course, produces these things on purpose. I think the most recent findings that plastics that we thought were benign may not be benign is a very big issue. And these industries are beginning to go back and redesign their products, look at what they have, go back to base one. We realize now we're going to have to test everything that we're going to put out into the environment.
But industry fights you every step of the way.
Of course. But I know they're working on it. I have seen response already. So,
what do you mean?
Changes in products. Advertising on television telling us how good a product is. We know industry is aware of our message. If they're aware of our message, they know that if they can design a product that they can release to the public, put up for sale, and say, my product is biologically benign, it's not going to affect the future generations. They will have a product that is competitively ahead of anyone else. And with international action like this, they'll have a product they can sell globally.
What about Britain? Where do they stand in this worldwide effort?
Well, unfortunately, Britain did not sign on to the North Sea Treaty last summer. The eight Baltic countries did, but Britain did not.
Why not?
I really don't know. I know there are a number of people working over there doing some of the leading science in the field of male reproduction, detergents in the environment. They're looking at detergents, plastics. They're big help. They're really – the scientists – the scientific community knows this. Let's put it this way. And this is general knowledge worldwide among the scientific community. And I think as we reach out and reach our policymakers and concerned people, we'll see changes.
Are you at all dismayed by the lack of discussion of environmental issues at the presidential campaign level?
Oh, yes. I sit there every time I hear a speech or look at what's in the paper and think, don't they realize that our underlying wealth is in our natural resources and in our children? And we have got to take them into consideration. Until we consider environmental issues in everything we do, we are not going to have a very healthy, happy world to live in.
Have you ever been called to testify before Congress?
Yes, I have.
On what issue?
This issue. I've been talking about this since 1988, I believe. No, it was 89 when I first started testifying.
And what direction do you think politics in this country are going and legislation is going to increase the kind of endocrine disruptors that you've been describing and dioxin in the environment?
To increase them? I think that's the way the legislation looks right now. It's very gloomy. We have got to give more support to EPA. EPA needs help on this. They're aware of the problem. The public thinks that there are a lot of people out there protecting them. They think we have big laboratories and everything they touch is safe. Little do they know the trivial amount of money that's going into assessing the safety of the products that they're exposed to every day.
What about the effect of industry on academic research? I mean, a couple of weeks ago, we were talking with John Stauber, who wrote the book Toxic Sludge is Good for You, about the PR industry. And we were talking about one of the new products that's out on the market, Olestra from Procter & Gamble. They are pouring millions of dollars into PR around this fat-free molecule, this molecule that's too big into the body, and so it just oozes right out. And one of the things we discovered was the amount of money that they are pouring into academic institutions. And then you, of course, get the scientists, the deans of community medical schools, you know, schools of community medicine, et cetera, actually endorsing the product, or at least saying it doesn't create as much damage as you think. What effect does industry have on academic research, the academia you come out of?
I see it more and more. I also think that there has to be more federal money moving into our institutions of higher learning so that we can avoid this kind of conflict. And it's really very interesting because as I began talking about these chemicals that don't damage the gene, remember the gene is not damaged here. All these chemicals do is tell the gene to do something at the wrong time or not at the right time. So and I've spoken to scientists about this, and they've said, we love what you're doing. We were doing research like this back in the 1970s, 79. But in order to keep our postdocs working, to maintain our technicians in our laboratory, we had to write proposals for other kind of research. And specifically, for many, many years, it's been strictly cancer. Now, I don't think that we should ever stop trying to protect ourselves from cancer. I think that's very important. But they have all said this is the only way they could get money was through specific immediate problems and not do what we need to have more done of is basic research. We don't understand how the natural system operates. And until we understand that better, we can't deal with these kind of problems.
The direction Congress is going in now, it seems, from public broadcasting to public institutions, educational institutions, is to say private industry can do a better job of funding them.
That's what they're saying. Well, that's the way that's the way the cookie's crumbling today. I think we'll see the pendulum shift back.
Your strategy in getting the word out about our stolen future?
My strategy to get the word out? Well, to accept invitations from people like you. Lecture on college campuses, still go out and talk to the scientific community. Once an open-minded scientist hears this story, generally, when an open-minded scientist hears this story, they understand it. We have a tremendous amount of scientists who are endorsing our book.
As we wrap up right now, can you tell us what you recommend to people on an individual level and even on a community level to protect themselves from these toxins that you describe in our stolen future?
Well, for one thing, be very careful about the water they drink, especially if you live in the middle part of the country or you're dependent upon community or wells. We know the groundwater is contaminated almost entirely throughout the Midwest where the agricultural chemicals have been poured into the ground. Also, we're recommending to everyone until you find out better, don't heat your food in your microwave in plastic. Switch to glass temporarily until you find out whether the plastics are safe.
How do you know?
You don't know, and that's what we're calling for in the book. We say the public has a right to know what's in the products they're purchasing and using, and we want the manufacturers to be able to put on their labels what is in the product so then the consumer can make a decision about whether they want to use these products or not. And then, of course, be very, very discriminate about how you use pesticides and around your children. Grow dandelions. Don't worry about dandelions in your lawn. Forget the lawn care products, that sort of thing. And form community neighborhood groups if you want to keep your neighborhoods pesticide-free. You can do it. It's happening around the country. And, of course, support the organic grower or become an organic grower yourself. Buy as much organically grown produce as you can.
We thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Theo Colburn, who is co-author of the book, Our Stolen Future, Are We Threatening Our Fertility, Intelligence, and Survival? A Scientific Detective Story. Get the information and then go out on the campaign trail and challenge the presidential candidates. This is your chance. This is your chance to get access to them. This is your chance, the one little window that you have before the presidential election, that maybe, possibly, you'll get an answer to some of your questions. You're listening to Democracy Now! I am Amy Goodman. And before we move on to our next subject, which is the counterterrorism bill, as it's being called now, that was just passed through the House, we want to ask this question again. If you were listening yesterday, you already heard it, but we want to get a response from you. What makes a person qualified to be president of the United States? We want to know what you think. How much and what kind of prior government experience is necessary? Do you think that someone who'd become president should have worked in a public interest nonprofit group before they become president to prove their interest in the public interest? Should they be a parent? Should they know what it's like to work for minimum wage? Should the president have served in the military or be an anti-war protester? What should she or he have accomplished in their lives before seeking the nation's highest office? This week, Democracy Now! Is asking you to think about these questions and write us a job description for the presidency. Get a pen and we'll tell you where to send your ideas. You can write it like a formal job description, a classified ad, or you can submit an imaginary resume of a candidate you could support. Please send your presidential job descriptions with your daytime telephone number to Democracy Now! 702 H Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 2001. You can fax it to 202-737-3723. Or via email at democracy@pacifica.org. Democracy Now! Will post some of the best responses on the Pacifica webpage and will forward them to President Clinton and GOP frontrunner Bob Dole. We got one response after yesterday we put out this question. And part of that response, it's from Jack Knutson. Dear Democracy Now!, a president should possess all the characteristics that make an individual noble in spirit, self-sacrificing, concerned for the welfare of others, especially the downtrodden, willing to take risks at the expense of one's own life and status, diplomacy and thought and action, above all, the lack of concern for what others think of them. A president should be decisive but flexible, strong but pliable, intelligent with common sense, scholarly but not pedantic, vigorous but not lascivious, approachable but not venal, patriotic but not nationalistic, economic but not miserly, and he goes on from there. He ends by saying the president can't be a saint, being so preoccupied with worldly affairs, but a faith in that which transcends the mundane can help achieve all the previous mentioned qualities. Thank you for that, Jack Knutson. Well, join in and tell us where you think the president should be coming from and where you think she should be going. Well, we're moving now into the counterterrorism bill segment. You may have heard the news yesterday about the House passing a so-called counterterrorism bill. In the Washington Post today, it says a sharply divided House passed a diluted bill intended to fight crime and terrorism, but President Clinton said it was too weak to be effective. He said this on Air Force One when he was flying to Washington from Jerusalem, where he pledged to help the Israelis fight terrorism. The measure passed on a 229 to 191 vote one day after a coalition of conservative Republicans and pro-gun Democrats voted to remove key provisions, arguing they would have given too much power to federal law enforcement officials in the name of combating terrorists. It's interesting that it characterizes pro-gun Democrats, because I think there were a lot of people in that coalition who were not pro-gun, but were very concerned about threats to constitutional rights and liberties of American citizens. And we're now going to discuss the issue. We're going to begin with one man who has a personal story to tell. One of the provisions that was not taken out of the House counterterrorism bill was the limitation on habeas corpus, the limitation on death row inmates' rights to appeal. We're joined now on the telephone from New Jersey by Jimmy Landano. And Jimmy Landano knows well what the criminal justice system is all about. He was incarcerated for 14 years, convicted of killing a police officer. And it was only after 14 years, after a long uphill legal battle, that he was able to prove that he had not killed the officer. Jimmy Landano, welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
It's nice to have you with us. I want to let our listeners know that coming up, we are joined by Bud Walsh, who's from Oklahoma City. He owns a gasoline service station there. His daughter, Julie, was killed in the Oklahoma City bombing. He's quite concerned about the counterterrorism bill. And we're also joined by Leslie Hagan, who is legislative director of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. And she's been very involved in fighting the counterterrorism bill. And on the line with us from the Justice Department is Nick Guess. He is the Director of Intergovernmental Relations at the Justice Department, very much a supporter of the original counterterrorism bill, and we'll be having a debate on that issue, particularly around the issue of habeas corpus. And Jimmy Landano, why don't we start by you telling us what habeas corpus is? No matter how much we hear it, I think people don't understand it.
Well, habeas corpus, what it actually does is it allows the federal court to some degree to oversee the state courts. I'm getting an echo on the phone. Is that whatever? But what it amounts to is if a state court convicts an individual, any individual, but the misconception is that habeas corpus applies only to death penalty cases. Now, that's a lie that the politicians would have us believe, because people have a thirst for blood. We want executions in this country. We want an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But the Hague was put in place so that the sovereignties, the states themselves, when they wrongly convict, and most of the time knowingly wrongly convict someone and sentence them to the rest of their life or death, that there'll be an independent court to take a look at it.
How did it help you in your case?
Well, in 1976, I was arrested for the murder of a police officer. Contrary to the physical description of the killer by all witnesses, I was arrested, I was tried, I was convicted, sentenced to life plus 15 years, and all through that 13 years of incarceration, the prosecutors, the attorney generals, all said that I was just whistling in the wind when I said there has to be some kind of evidence proving that I did not do this crime, because, first of all, I did not fit the physical description, which was the hardest thing to accept. And second, you know, I had no knowledge of the crime. Eyewitnesses that were coerced or pressured, we found out 13 years later, I had no reason to know why they were lying. And the state prosecutors and the attorney generals, as I said, said there was nothing in their files to prove that anybody else was a possible suspect.
We have 1 minute before our break.
Okay.
How did you ultimately use habeas corpus to get out of jail?
Well, you don't use habeas corpus. See, that's a misconception. Habeas corpus is your right as an American citizen, is to make sure, that's why we ran away from England, to make sure that someone else is looking in. Now, what happened was a judge signed an ex parte order in 1989. After all my appeals were done, the United States Supreme Court didn't want to hear my case. In May of 1989, 4 months later, we found one document, a police report, that an eyewitness had identified the real killer. We took that document back to a federal judge who had denied me habeas corpus relief. He had deferred to a state court finding. That judge then ordered an ex parte order. The next morning at 9 o'clock, the United States Marshals raided the police municipalities, including the Attorney General's office in New Jersey, and confiscated all the files in relation to my case. And lo and behold, one page after another in those files showed that my photograph was shown to the eyewitnesses and was discounted, saying your hair wasn't right, it was curlier, so forth and so on. Within 2 weeks, the conviction was thrown out. I was released the following day, which was July 28, 1989. And since that time, we still haven't gotten any further as far as any documents from them other than what we found.
Jimmy Landana, we have to take a break.
Okay.
He's telling us the story of how habeas corpus was a factor in his life and his release. You're listening to Democracy Now! We're talking about the counterterrorism bill, and we'll be back with Bud Welch, who will talk about the bill from his own personal perspective. You are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The counterterrorism bill, the original bill, was one of the centerpieces of the Clinton administration, so-called counterterrorist strategy. President Clinton says he's extremely disappointed with what has happened in Congress. We're going to find out just what the bill was, what is it is now. But before we go to our discussion, and particularly around the issue of habeas corpus, and we'll be talking with the National Association of Legal Criminal defense lawyers, as well as the Justice Department. We want to bring in Bud Welch, who is an owner of a gas service station in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, and whose life was changed dramatically last year when the Alfred Murrah Federal Building was blown up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Bud.
Good morning, Amy.
Morning. Why don't you tell us what happened last year?
Well, I lost my 23-year-old daughter, Julie. She was a recent graduate of Marquette University in Milwaukee in the summer of 94. And a month after I brought her home from Milwaukee, she got a job with the Social Security Administration. She was a Spanish translator for them. And she had only been there 7 months. And the morning of the bombing, she had an appointment with a Mexican man that was couldn't speak English. And his minister had brought him to Social Security. And Julie had walked from the rear of the building to the front of the building, the waiting area, for her appointment. And en route back to her desk with the two men, the bomb exploded, and their three bodies were found together. Mm-hmm. And Julie was my only daughter, and we were very, very close. It's been a very traumatic thing getting through this, and of course, you know, closure or getting through it simply isn't going to happen.
What about this counterterrorism bill that was hailed by the president as a way to prevent something like this from happening again? What is your feeling about that?
My feelings about it, you know, we were victimized on April 19th of last year, and I almost feel like that I've been victimized again. If not victimized, certainly taken advantage of, because I think a lot of the congressmen or a lot of the politicians, period, have used the family members of the victims to put forth their own agendas without really any consideration for our feelings and for our wishes. And later, Leslie can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I don't think there's a line in the entire bill that addresses fighting crime. I don't think that, I don't think there's any wording in the bill that that comes up with more funding for example, public defense offices to get criminals off the street, have their trials fast instead of them making bond, which I'm not opposed to them going out on bond, but I'm opposed to them staying out on the streets for a year and a half. Waiting for their trial because there is improper funding to expedite these trials. And I think that's just wrong that
that the innocent people that may have this hanging over their head for a year and a half, the guilty people are out on the street maybe committing more crimes. And I don't think there's anything in there to address that. And until we start addressing some of those issues, I think this fighting crime, fighting terrorism is nothing but a smokescreen.
Well, let's bring Leslie Hagan and Nick Guess into this conversation. Leslie Hagan, Legislative Director of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, and Nick Guess, the Director of Intergovernmental Relations over at the Justice Department. Why don't we begin with Nick Guess? Why don't you summarize what the bill intended to do and what's happened to it?
Thanks, Pam. What the bill intended to do was, first, it was sent up in February, several months before the Oklahoma City bombing, to deal with the burgeoning threat from international terrorism. Oklahoma City, I think, changed this country forever. I've never had a chance to talk personally with Bud Welch, but I have had a chance to deal with some of the Oklahoma City victims. And while their loss is obviously an absolutely personal one, I don't think there's anybody in this country who will ever whose life wasn't changed by that day. Several weeks later, President Clinton transmitted a supplement to the international terrorism bill to deal with some of the issues that are investigative needs to cope with domestic terrorism issues as well. These will assist not only in domestic terrorism investigations, but in criminal and foreign counterintelligence matters as well. They were a measured response, which are designed effectively to protect American lives without trampling on American rights. And that was a precondition of what the president asked us to do when we drafted.
Trampling on American rights. Leslie Hagan, that's how you've basically described this so-called counterterrorism bill. What is your perspective on it? First, if you could tell us what your battle was about as the bill was going through Congress in the last few days and who you've allied yourself with, and then what it's become.
Well, the bill really did not strike that proper measure of being sensitive to civil rights and liberties. And it should tell us something, I think, that common ground on civil rights and liberties was found by groups as diverse as the American Civil Liberties Union, Amnesty International, the Friends Committee, the Quakers, the Irish National Caucus headed up by a priest, Father McManus, the National Black Police Association, the Law Enforcement Alliance of America, and the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, and indeed some gun groups.
The National Rifle Association.
The
you were working
National
with.
Rifle Association, among others, really the entire Second Amendment community.
What is your common cause with them?
Well, the NRA has not been a friend of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers in the past. In fact, last year they were championing things that we were very much opposed to and continue to be. For example, this habeas package that is just awful that is in this bill. You know, yesterday was a very, very disappointing day for us as well because of the way habeas was scapegoated and, very unfortunately, the way the comments of the President of the United States from Larry King Live of June 5th, 1995, a day or two before the Senate rushed through a terrible terrorism bill on June 7th, just a month or two after the Oklahoma City bombing. Those comments were waved around on the floor yesterday by the House.
What were the comments?
To the extent, I think it was Chairman Hyde answering the concerns, I believe, that had been articulated by four former attorney generals of the United States, two Republicans and two Democratic appointees, who were saying that the bill is unconstitutional, the habeas package of the bill is unconstitutional in their view. I understand they've communicated that concern to the president.
What's unconstitutional about it?
Well, for one thing, it would force federal courts for really the first time, and this is an area somewhat subject to debate, but it's certainly true that the federal courts have never been forced to defer to constitutionally erroneous state court decisions on matters of federal law, at least since 1867.
What do you mean specifically? I mean, we're talking with a lay audience
here.
No,
I know. Specifically, if the state court made a determination, such as in Jimmy Londano's case, that was unconstitutional as a matter of federal law, say due process or what have you, this bill would force the federal courts on the habeas review to defer to that constitutional construction, even if the federal courts thought that it was wrong as a matter of constitutionality.
So even if they say it's wrong, they say they would have to abide by the state
right,
law.
Unless it was wholly unreasonable according to clearly established Supreme Court law. And as Nick knows, I'm sure, the Supreme Court cannot review very many cases. And in fact, the Rehnquist Court has already cut back significantly on people's ability to get review anyway.
So this means that, for example, it's not just death row inmates, but death row inmates will have less chance of having a fair federal review.
Absolutely. And this is happening at the same time that they are, in fact, gutting funding, not just at the trial level in death cases, which are all important, but at the post-conviction stage. This Congress gutted that funding a couple of months ago as well.
Nick Guest, can you explain this provision, why the president supports it?
Certainly. And in fact, I think it's important to note that while the president has very strongly supported the need for the reform of habeas corpus, and more importantly, to assure that punishment for the guilty is swift and certain, there are provisions of the habeas law that we would prefer to have seen differently, and this is one of them. But that does not mean that overall, as a conceptual matter, the president doesn't support it and won't sign a bill that contains it. But the fact of the matter is, what we're talking about here really is apples and oranges. I only know about the Jimmy Landona case from what I've read in the newspapers and obviously what I've heard today. But the fact remains that what appears to have happened in that case is that state and local authorities did not tell the truth during their own post-conviction, that is, habeas corpus proceedings under New Jersey law. And those should have sufficed. It has been very clear law, Supreme Court precedent, in fact, since the mid-1960s, that a prosecutor has an absolute duty, even if not asked, has a duty to turn over so-called exculpatory information. In other words, information which would tend to suggest that the person who has been accused didn't do the crime. This bill wouldn't change that, because this would have been newly discovered evidence, or at least, as I understand, a factual formulation. Our concern here isn't that people should be denied the ability to file a federal habeas petition after they have had all their state appeals, all their state habeas proceedings. Our concern is that those should be filed in a timely fashion and resolved in a timely fashion.
Leslie Hagan, you are shaking your head.
Yeah, I really do want to address that. Unfortunately, that's one of the myths no disrespect, Nick, but unfortunately, it's one of the things that we've heard as a response to our concerns about habeas corpus. This habeas corpus package of this bill has been a response that sounds something like what I understand you just said, which is that this bill would still allow someone with newly discovered evidence to file a petition for federal review of habeas corpus. The question is, what can a federal court do with that piece of paper that everyone, of course, has the right to file? The question is, what can a federal court do? And this bill guts the ability of federal courts to meaningfully review it. Newly discovered evidence, such as in Jimmy's case or federal case, if we want to look at the federal habeas, that blatantly reflected a subversion of this exculpatory evidence that tends to show someone's innocence. If that came to light only years after the fact, after the deadlines have passed, it's true this bill says you can still file a petition, but only if you can show that but for that piece of hidden evidence, no fact finder, no one juror on 12, on a jury of 12, could possibly have found you guilty. It shifts the burden of presumption to the shoulders of the accused, convicted. And in life and death cases are the most important, but in non-death cases, folks don't even have a statutory right to counsel. They'll have to meet that burden, which is unmeetable. I clerked for a federal judge in the Death Belt in Texas, and I know that's an unmeetable standard even for a brilliant federal judge to find with a petition that's been filed by able counsel. And again, we're gutting the resources for even death penalty lawyers. It's an unmeetable standard.
Nick Guess.
Amy, to make that real clear, we're not gutting it. The fact is, and it's absolutely true, it's going to be hard to do. We think it should be hard to do.
Impossible.
We think it should be – no, it's not impossible. The fact of the matter is, it's going to be very hard It should be hard. It should be a high standard. We're not talking about an accused. That's the wrong term to use. We are talking about a convicted person, a person who has been found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, either by a jury or upon a plea of guilty.
Jimmy,
Jimmy
Landana, you wanted to say something. You were convicted.
Yes. I take exception to that statement. Because a person's convicted does not make them guilty. That's what we would love to have people believe. I mean, every day we are finding out more and more people have been convicted of crimes they did not commit and are released. But the big question I want to say is the politicians and the attorneys for the government are acting like habeas corpus is releasing people every day by the tons. There are approximately 8,000 habeas corpus petitions by prisoners across this country filed each year. And I'll be willing to bet that less than 200 individuals ever get any kind of relief. And that, again, does not mean that they are not innocent. A lot of them are innocent. A lot of people that were innocent went to their deaths. And what do we say when that happens? Oh, all systems have flaws. There's cracks in all systems. You're talking about taking someone's life, and 9 out of 10 times, it's because the unsavory characters that have been vested with serving justice play a dirty game at trials during the investigations. Prosecutors and attorney generals are not rewarded for losing cases. They are only rewarded when they win a case, and they have the machinery, so they do it as they damn well please. As I'm living proof, and there's hundreds of individuals such as myself that have served 13 unnecessary years in a maximum security prison, have lost my family, lost prime years of my life. When individuals knew that they were standing before the court lying that I was the killer, and after 13 years, when we found those documents, what's done then? You tell the prosecutor, don't do it again. You know that was a Brady violation? That's not right. My thinking should be when you catch a prosecutor doing something like that, then he has to serve day for day with the individual he illegally convicted.
We're going to have to wrap up, and I wanted to get a final comment from Bud Welch out in Oklahoma City. Bud, when we talked earlier, you were concerned about a number of provisions of the bill that were cut out of the House bill but remain in the Senate bill around, for example, illegal wiretapping or around increasing the scope of wiretapping.
Amy, rather than address that right now, what I would like to point out is that I've listened to this discussion for the last half hour, and we have not talked about a single thing that has anything to do with anti-terrorism or what we were presented in Oklahoma City. You know, the haste in this legislation was because of the bombing in Oklahoma City, and to have this all done and signed by April the 19th. But yet, here we're not addressing any of those issues. I feel like, as a family member, that we have been misled, we have been lied to. And all of these other agendas have came forward, and they passed this legislation, and they didn't serve my family when they passed it.
Bud Welch, I want to thank you very much. We do have to go. Bud Welch, Jimmy Landano, Nick Yes, and Leslie Hagan, thanks for being with us. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin with assistance from Pat Greenfield, our engineer, Kenneth Mason. I'm Amy Goodman. Join me Monday for another edition of Democracy Now!